This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We are talking about great plants for fall interest in your garden today. And back with us is Liz Fremont. She is a provider of concierge horticulture services through her business, The Garden Hoe. What gardening questions do you need answers to? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Liz, it's always so great to see you.
Oh, likewise. Pleasure to be here. And the listeners are always good for some really challenging questions, which
she's
is wonderful.
For them.
Oh, I am. Play Stump Liz today.
Oh, I like it. We need to get that buzzer or bell going, Lee. Yeah. Well, we usually have some kind of easy ones, and then we always have some stumpers. So, yeah, if you think you got a stumper for Liz, give us a call, 800-642-1234. But we are specifically talking about some cool plants, trees, shrubs, vines, etc., that add something to the garden in the fall, because it can start to look a little dreary.
Right, and we are tired. Gardeners are tired at this point in the year. And so what we're going to talk about are things that look good in the fall, but not necessarily that you should plant in the fall. So this is a list to look ahead for next year. And actually right now, these are all going to be in bloom if you go to the garden centers or if you go to private gardens, public gardens, so you can see what they look like and see whether you'd like them in your yard and then plan for it. Go out and purchase them next year and put them in early in the year or, you know, when it's appropriate.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you just went through my first three questions. So.
No, we didn't practice.
We did not practice. So what were you looking for when you made this list up?
I was looking for plants that would add interest and color to the yard, not necessarily always flowers, but because you're not going to get that with shrubs and trees for the most part. Now, one tree that I absolutely love, and I've talked about it frequently when I've been on, is Heptacodium. Heptacodium myconoides is not a native plant, so you native people out there, don't yell at me. I know it's not a native, but it is one of the very few plants that is not invasive and for us, and it flowers now. It's actually setting the buds now, and they come out nice and creamy white, and it's got a common name of Seven Suns flower, it's in sevens. So the blossoms are in sevens. The everything when you start looking at it is like, wow, there's a lot of sevens on this plant. But it also goes back to long ago China, and the plant actually got the name Seven Suns, yes, because of the amount, but also it had to do with the seventh son of, you know, whatever dynasty was in place. And this is a Chinese plant. It was dated by Harvard back maybe 2 to 3 million years. So it's been around for quite some time. And when they flooded the valley, the huge valley, it kind of disappeared, and then it showed up again upland. So they found it wet sites, upland sites, and it just has continued on and on. Very interesting tree. It smells wonderful, smells a bit like honey. And then after the flowers are done, then we get fruit on it that is kind of looks a little bit like baby Sputniks, and they're maroon in color. Ooh. And so that actually looks more like a quote-unquote flower than the flower itself. But they're setting their buds right now. The bark is fascinating. So during the rest of the year, you have the bark to look at, and the leaves are pretty. And it's got a little bit of a messy habit, but it gives you something to do, go out and trim off, you know, some of them. But that's one. That's about the only one that flowers right now.
Okay. And so what are we looking at? Height-wise, width-wise, what is it like? Sun, shade?
Yep. It's okay. One of those that I have tried in a number of different sites. It gets very tall. It will get to be about 20 feet, a little bit plus, in a nice full sun situation. In the shade, it tends to stay just a pinch shorter, but it still will get up to be about 15 feet or so. I've tried it in a bunch of different sites on my at my house, and Does fine.
Wow. What about growing zones?
Zones, you know, we're still kind of figuring that one out, how far north it'll go, but I have had no trouble whatsoever down by Milwaukee area. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're looking at how far north can they go. I know Johnson's Nursery has them up north of Milwaukee, so we know they live up there, and it's just how far north, that's kind of what needs to be tested a little bit.
If anybody has one of those seven sun trees, right, please let us know if you're listening, especially if you're up further north. So
absolutely. So, I mean, those are the trees that's flowering now. Same thing with shrubs. There's not a whole lot that flowers right now. We've got viburnums that are in flower, which are always great. The St. John's wort is in flower. That will be in flower for a little bit. That is a great shrub as a pollinator, especially at the time, you know, right now that it's blooming. And that has great fall color. So once the flowers are done, the leaves turn into, especially one that's called blue velvet, if I remember it correctly. That one has three colors on almost every leaf. So it goes to like an orange, a red, and a slightly bluish green color. So it's really, really quite pretty. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, we'll go back to trees. Parodia is a tree that is not native, but it's related to our ironwoods and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's a Turkish tree, and that has also the most phenomenal fall color on its leaves. Not invasive, and you can find substitutes for it that are somewhat native, in case somebody is concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's always good to know. Mm-hmm. And we do worry about the invasiveness
Absolutely.
Of some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that burning bush, which you see, you know, almost everybody has one in their yard at some point, but some of those are terribly invasive.
Horribly. And I know that they are breeding sterile cultivars of that, but how sterile they are, you know, yes, you can do X amount of research and then you have to release it at some point. You can't research forever.
Sure.
But they are coming up with some good sterile varieties. But we always don't know what is out there. And so to me, yes, it's a beautiful fall shrub. It's got gorgeous color, but it's not worth it. Mm-hmm. It's just not worth putting in.
Yeah. And they have thorns on them. So
yeah, they're a little picky.
They're
a little picky.
So what would you suggest if somebody has some and like, you know what, I agree, let's get rid of this.
Mm-hmm.
What's a good substitute for burning bush?
Well, depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for color, there are sumacs that do give you that same color, but you're talking about something that takes a lot of space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hate to say this, but there is not a whole lot that is going to give you that phenomenal fall color like burning bush does. But I would look at the St. John's wort, again, because it's got multiple colors on each leaf that you really do get an excellent, excellent color on it.
Now, is that different then from the St. John's wort that is like an herb?
It is. Well, same family, but a little bit different as far as habit.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that I have been trialing are good up to zone 4. And I know you can find them, that they are good shrubs. You do have to be careful when you go to purchase something like that, that you're looking at the zone, because many places will carry those that are really annual for us. And those are the ones when you're talking herbs. Those are a little bit more tender varieties, and they aren't going to survive our winters.
Okay.
So the shrubs have been proving to be really quite good at surviving.
Mm-hmm.
I have found I've been playing with them for a while, and you can really be brutal with them every spring. Cut them off, you know, like you do with spirea, and they'll come back. If you let them kind of go, they get a little rangy and their trunks get a little big. So if you don't control where you want it to grow right away and you try cutting it back a little bit later in its life, it's going to say, okay, I'm done. So that's something, yes, you know, we do have to be a little careful of. Dogwood, like red twig dogwood, and yellow twig dogwood, golden dogwood, those are good for more winter color as opposed to fall color, because the leaves are pretty, but they're not outstanding.
Mm-hmm. Now, with those dogwoods, is it like the natives where they're red or colored during the winter time, but then they
They look like a shrub the rest of the year. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And the stems do have a reddish hue, but they're really especially vibrant mm-hmm. during the winter, you know, very, very late fall and then through winter.
Yeah. They're beautiful at mm-hmm. that point. So what else do you got in shrubs?
What else do we have in shrubs? I'm going to have to get my list up because I'm old and the
Not old. You're wise and experienced.
We'll go with both of those. Okay. I'm a wise old woman. Calocarpa is another one that is beauty berry. And that's not really that hardy for further up north. Mm-hmm. That's more of a midsection of the country shrub, and you'll find it growing wild down in Missouri and other places. And so you can find some pretty good wild stuff out there. And there is white beauty berry, but the purple is good if you've got a kind of a protected spot. That mm-hmm. will actually do pretty well. It does not look good for about 60% of its life because it's a great plant for the fall, but it's slow to emerge. And when it does, it looks a little scraggly. And then all of a sudden it takes off during the summer. You get the berries on it, and then it kind of goes vleh. Ah, so it's a very specialized plant. Mm-hmm. Aronia I've got on the list to go backwards a little bit. Aronia is a fantastic shrub, and anybody in this area can go to the Arboretum and see the wonderful collection that they've got of Aronia. That was Dr. Hasselkiss's. That was one of his favorite plants. And it is an edible berry. It has a lot of tannins in it, so definitely you have to cook it. It's not one that you eat raw, you know, or to the detriment of your liver, that's for sure. Caryopteris is one. That one is often called blue mist spirea or a false spirea is white flowering. This one, blue mist, is flowering now, and it will flower all the way through September. And the flowers are great for cut. They're blue, they're pretty, and they have a really nice scent. This shrub is interesting in that it's blue, number one, bluish. You know, everything is kind of purpley blue.
Yes.
But this one is very particular. It's not particular about where you put it. And in fact, it loves crappy soil. And it'll take drought once it's established. But if you cut it too early in the spring, it's one of those that says, okay, I'm done. Thank you. We had a good time, but I'm going to go. And you wait until the leaves start emerging, and then you can go in and prune. If you prune before that, it just sets it back, and it doesn't like it.
Okay. And just so you all know, Liz's list is on our website. So you just go to WPR.org/Larry, and you looked for today's episode, and it's underlined there. It says Liz's List. Yes. So you can click on that, and there it is in all its glory. We are talking to Liz Fremont today. She's a provider of concierge horticulture services through her business, The Garden Hoe. If you've got a question for her, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send us an email, and that's talk@WPR.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Stay with us today. It's coming up in the last half hour. We're going to talk about what plants don't grow well together. And we'll also find out about how to pick your peppers, knowing when they're ripe. But right now, we're talking about fun plants that are adding interest to the fall garden. And we've got a call from Fred Liz, and he's in Wheaton with something. Go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, I got an answer for you on the fall color.
Go right ahead.
It's a native.
To replace
the native, it comes in all kinds.
To replace burning bush? Is that what you were?
Yes, and okay. I had, yep. Drum roll, please. It's blueberry. And it comes in all sizes. You got to figure that out when you buy them. But all sizes, I had a side-by-side with burning bush and blueberry, and the blueberry gave it a real run for its money, if not better than burning bush.
Okay. Any specific kind?
Soil acidity is a problem. You got to have acid soil.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, you know, and I love blueberries, but for us, you're in Wheaton, so you must have to add a bit to the soil in order to get it to do well.
No, it's Wheaton, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Do you have acidic soil?
Yes.
Okay.
Soil sulfur is good.
You're up north, right?
Yes. But if you had sandy soil, it's a lot easier to amend the soil.
You're absolutely right. It is. In the southern part of the state, people are going to have a little bit, well, a lot more difficulty growing the blueberries because of our soil pH. But that's a wonderful suggestion for people up north. And there are a number of great cultivars out there for blueberries that if you have the soil for it, go for it. That is wonderful. Another one that we don't think about, and I didn't put on my list, is peonies. Peonies have great fall color if you let them go that long. They have great spring color and great fall color on their leaves.
My peonies have great black spots on their leaves.
Oh, it just adds to the joy, yeah. Doesn't it?
It's like they're little leopard plants.
You need to get some more peonies, different ones.
Yeah. They've been there for a very, very, very long time. So and they do have a great show, but they almost always get spots.
Yeah, they're prone to that, the botrytis. And if it's a cultivar that's going to get it, it's going to get it. And, you know, if conditions are right, it's susceptible. So, but the only thing you can do would be to replace them. But then it takes 10, 15 years to get that same show back that you've got.
Yeah. I'll put up with it. So, So we did get a email from Sue in Madison, and she sent us a photo. It's a 6-year-old Seven Suns shrub, and she took it today. It's just setting blossoms, just like you described, and she got it to provide late-season blooms for pollinators. It's very pretty. Nice leaves. I like those leaves.
They're almost, well, they are tropical in look. They're big, and that's something that we don't get out of a lot of our natives. And so that's why I'm not opposed to using some of these plants as long as they're not invasive, as long as we don't have a problem with it. Because getting textural interest in our yards is difficult in this part of the country if you're talking size of leaf and, you know, a little bit different look. And so this is one that I've tested, and I have not had any babies pop up anywhere around it at all, period.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, long, darker green kind of, was it? Quite a few leaves per branch. So.
Yep. It's really an interesting tree. Mm-hmm. So if you have a chance to see one in person, go ahead and take a look.
Yeah.
The bark is got great color striations on it. It'll be blue and green undertones on this kind of creamy tan. It's really, really quite lovely.
Well, you can all stop over to Sue's in Madison.
There you go. Sue will love that. Sorry, Sue. Sorry. We won't put your address
out. No, we will not. We will not. I'm sure there's plenty of Sue's in Madison, though. So, all right. Well, let's get back to our list. We were in the shrub area.
Yeah, some of the ones that we can add in most places. Clethra is a good one, and that is also called summer sweet. And the work they're doing on the blossoms is wonderful. They're in flower now, and they will continue to flower for a little while. It's more of an upright-ish shrub until it gets a bit older, and then you'll see the branches kind of arching out a little bit. But it's one that you can control the size on. You can easily trim it back a little bit every year and really change the shape according to what you need. So it responds fairly well. And most plants, if they're shrubs, if they're fall flowering, late summer or early fall flowering, you can prune those, you know, like you would a panicled hydrangea. You can prune them almost all the way up into June, and they'll still,
Give you something.
And this one I would go a little bit earlier. I wouldn't prune past about March, April. Okay. But I have had it flower if I did it late.
What about when you were talking about upright shrubs? Is this something that's positioned a little bit further back, like in a bed, with something maybe that's
medium,
not like that?
Yeah. Medium height. I mean, it can't get to be 6-8 feet tall. Yeah. So, you know, we're talking if there is a taller, you know, like if you're looking at arbs or something like that, this is kind of a medium sized shrub.
Yeah, that's always important to know because we tend to put them in the wrong places, don't we?
We do. And I have a friend that I won't name because I don't want to embarrass him. But when he gets new plants, he puts them all in the front. and then I go move them because that's where they are. You know, that's where the spot was because I moved everything from the front and put it to the middle and the back where it belongs. So sometimes things go in the front anyway.
Well, I planted some shrubs and two of the three died. So I bought something else to put in there this year. Well, one of the ones that quote unquote died came back up. So I'm like, all right, well, which one of you all have to move because this isn't going to work. So,
The clethra is a great plant. Another one on the list is hibiscus. We've got a couple different ones that do well here. It's the Rose of Sharon, which is a cereacus, and that's a really hardy shrub that, again, you can hack and whack on that one and it's perfectly happy. And there are a lot of beautiful cultivars out there, you know, double flowering, single. Yeah, the flowers are not particularly huge, but you can still see that relationship between that hibiscus and a tropical hibiscus that you might bring in, the flower shape, et cetera, coloring. But one that we're seeing a lot more interest in and work being done are the large dinner plate size, the mosquitoes. Those are perfectly hardy for us, perfectly hardy. And so we're seeing some wonderful breeding work being done on those. And an interesting little factoid that I found, I don't know what they're going to do with the research results, but there was research done that tested the pollinating capabilities of those with the dark centers and those without. And the dark centers, they came up with that those are really like a target for the pollinators. Uh-huh. And so they're not, as I said, I don't know where they're going to go with this information. Was it for the pollinators or was there going to be some research into why is the plant doing this? Why are some have that target and others do not? What does that say about the really sturdy nature of each plant? So mm-hmm. We don't know that yet. But anyway, we do know the dark throat is better for getting the pollinators in.
I've been noticing so many of those mm-hmm. lately. And every time I see them, I'm like, oh, they're never going to survive the winter because they look so tropical. But there they are the next year.
They do. And there are a couple that came out in the last few years. One is called a beautiful white one that's called Marshmallow. And it was something Marshmallow. I don't remember what the second part of the name was. But that one is only going to be about 3 feet tall with those massive blooms on it. So it's going to look like just a cloud of flowers.
Wow.
And they had a red one in that same series. So, you know, if you see one that has the properties that you like, but not in the color, just keep looking in that series because I'm sure somebody will do something with it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. We're talking about fall interest in the garden today, but if you've got a question about anything in the garden, Liz can help you out with that. Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So we did have an email. It's kind of definitely a little bit out of what we're talking about for sure, but let's address it. CK email, they live in an apartment in Madison, but they're really interested in growing bonsai, but they would like to grow the trees in the ground because apparently they develop more vigorously. But because they don't have a yard, they're wondering if you had any ideas about where they could go to do this.
You know, wonderful question, and it's lovely that they have an interest in the bonsai because they are absolutely phenomenal. And if you ever have a chance to go to the National Arboretum in D.C., they have a beautiful collection of bonsai that are hundreds.
I was there in the spring. They're amazing.
Isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. And you look at those and you think hundreds of years old.
Yes.
And they're just so, so fascinating. My suggestion would be, especially if you don't have a plot of land for yourself, would be to get a hold of Bonsai Society and find out whether they have like an internship program, or maybe they can pair you with somebody who has some land or who can help you figure out what to do with the bonsai.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my suggestion. It's really out of my bailiwick. I hate to say this, I don't have the patience.
I know.
For
I want to
bonsai.
See results now.
yeah. And I'm old. I don't think I should start bonsai now, but that's just me.
We did have an expert on earlier this year, I think. So if you go to our website Ooh. And Google bonsai, you should be able to hear more information. But there are a number of gardens that mm-hmm. do feature those. So
absolutely. And mm-hmm. some even have traveling displays that are fantastical. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, a lot of information out there. Mm-hmm. So just check it out. Let's go back to the phone. We've got Carol in Green Bay with a question. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi, I have a question about my hibiscus. I had three beautiful plants for several years, and of course this spring, because of the crazy winter we had, they're gone. The only thing left are the little stems that are sticking out of the ground. My question is, do you think the roots are still there, that they may come back next year?
You know, I'm going to go with probably not. And these are the big flowering ones, right? The ones that die back to the ground every year?
Yes.
Yeah. If you haven't seen them by now, my guess would be no, that they're not going to come back. But I am actually patient enough to say, leave them in there and see what happens over winter. But if you dig around by those roots, you probably would be able to tell whether they're active or not. They come out in May or June. So we are really past that point where I would expect them to be out of the ground.
I've noticed that when I've got something that looks dead and I want to, mm-hmm. if it's really loose in the ground,
yes.
it tends to be dead.
You give it a little tug mm-hmm. and wishy-wishy. If it does that, then you might as well continue to pull and get it out.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're a little uncomfortable with that, then just dig next to it mm-hmm. and see if you can see what's there for
yeah.
roots. But unfortunately, no. And, you know, a lot of people think it was the cold or what have you that took them out. It was the lack of snow cover. Our plants will survive here because we usually have a lot of snow and they like that cover.
Yeah.
Not this year.
Yeah. So what do you suggest, Liz? I mean, is it a mulching thing that we should be doing coming up? Or
if you do, especially if you're going to plant anything this month or next month, what kind of a standard rule of thumb is wait until the ground freezes solid and then mulch over the top. And you can do that with leaves. You could do it if you've got mulch around there. What you have to remember, though, is if you don't wait until the ground freezes solid, you create bed and breakfast for the rodents over winter. So your good deed may, you know, not do you any good. So just wait until the ground freezes solid, then cover with mulch, and then start checking them in February and March. You don't want to leave that mulch on too long or it will rot the tissue that's coming up. And as soon as we get kind of calm temperatures in late winter, then you can start removing some of that mulch.
How deep do you recommend that we go?
Depends on the plant. If you're talking about a rose shrub that you want to, that might be grafted, that's going to be over the top of the graft, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
For something like this hibiscus, you really don't have to go very deep, maybe 8 inches, you know, just a nice mound over the crown.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what you're looking for.
Okay, great. Well, good luck, Carol.
Yeah.
You never know. But
no, you don't. Plants surprise us, but I'm kind of thinking they aren't going to surprise you this time.
Let's go to Penny in Winona, Minnesota. Go ahead, Penny.
Hi, Jill. So I have a question regarding collecting seed from, it was a hardy hibiscus and also my hollyhocks. The hibiscus, they're the smaller pink, like pale pink flowers
mm-hmm.
that put out a lot of seed on the pods.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mine didn't come back after last winter, after a couple of years. And do those seeds, the hollyhock and the hardy hibiscus like that, do they need to get a cold spell, or can I just collect them and then, you know, grow them from seed and then put them out next year?
Rule of thumb, and I don't have it in front of me, so I don't know what the length of time is for that, but rule of thumb, if it's something that's hardy for here, then it is probably going to need cold and damp on that seed in order for it to germinate. And so what I would do, go into the Google machine and put in hibiscus or whatever it is that you have, whether it's coneflower, hibiscus, anything, and ask what the cold treatment is. So if you put hibiscus cold treatment, you should actually get a nice table that comes up, and it will tell you how much and whether it has to be damp and or not. Generally speaking, yes. So kind of a damp sand is recommended for some, but not for others. So it's going to be particular for each plant that you're going to do. And that would be my recommendation. If I could remember it off the top of my head, I would tell you, but I can't.
That's a lot to remember, Liz. Yeah. So that's okay. We'll forgive you. But...
Thank you.
So good luck, Penny.
Yeah.
How fun.
It is. Now, do you remember, with any of the things you're saving from seed, if it is a hybrid, you aren't going to know what is going to pop up out of that seed, but that's kind of half the joy. I mean, it's fun. And what's the worst thing that can happen? You don't like it and you pull it out. That's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. But you may actually come up with something that you absolutely adore. And so give it a whirl. Why not?
Why not? Experiment. That's mm-hmm. half the fun. Were there any other shrubs that we wanted to talk about? I see you've got the oak leaf hydrangea on the list.
Yeah, the leaves on that, I mean, we're at the tail end. The flowers are gorgeous. That's mm-hmm. That is an acid plant that it does love some acid. Ah. So the soil, you know, here I can keep them for about 2 years without adding, and then they sort of just die out. But
I just bought one. Thanks, Liz.
You're welcome. But when they're gorgeous, they're phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
And the leaves will take on a beautiful reddish hue. And mm-hmm. so that and the flowers as they're starting to go from really, you know, nice white or pink, because there's some beautiful pinkish ones out there, that you then have the leaves. So, yeah, it is. And, you know, we have to take care of our people who have slightly acid soil also, because there aren't a lot of plants
that
will give you some fall color.
That's
so,
true.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll just watch it die again.
There you go. No, you know what? It'll be okay. It'll be okay. Give it some food. Have your soil tested. And as we always say, tell them what you're trying to grow so that you know exactly how much you need
there
to put
go.
On there.
Yep. I will do that.
Yep.
David Appleton, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, so I've always had questions on seeds from, say, flowers, coneflowers, whatever you may have. They start dropping this time of the year. Do they start germinating before winter? And if so, those tiny little plants, do they survive? And what about if I were to collect the seeds and just throw them on top of the snow in the winter? Would that work?
It can work. It is called frost seeding. And most of the time if you throw it on top of the snow, whatever birds are going to be around here are going to find them, and they're going to thank you for that if they sit on top of the snow for too long. You can definitely do that. I would go to, you can do all of the things that you had mentioned. You can collect the seed, you can let them drop, you can drop them on the ground yourself. I really don't catch that many coneflowers germinating before winter. So what you're going to get, you need cold treatment on those, and that's what's going to happen over winter. So you've got the cold treatment, you've got the scarification that you get from, you know, rubbing on the ground or what have you when it falls. And so that's going to take care of opening up that seed hull a little bit and allowing it to germinate. But typically that happens in the spring as opposed to in the winter. But if you do have something that's shooting out leaves, like hellebore, hellebore will shoot out leaves and flowers in December. If you look even under the snow, there's going to be flowers at the base of that plant, and the snow will sit on them all winter, and they're perfectly fine. So I take my instructions from the plant and what it does naturally, and then you try and mimic that. And so depending on what it is that you're collecting and trying to get to grow, that would be my approach.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Have fun with that, Dave.
Yeah.
We are talking to Liz Fremont. She's a provider of concierge horticulture services through her business, The Garden Hoe. What gardening questions are on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us again on Monday. We'll be talking tech, first answering your questions, and then we'll look at a new advances in controlling traffic lights. We're all in for that. And finally, how to boost your broadband. But right now, of course, we are talking plants, and we've got some people on the phone, Liz. Let's go to Laurel Coleman next. Go ahead, Laurel.
Okay, I have hostas, and the deer have eaten at least 80% of the leaves. Can I cut back the stem? Well, or do they need to be left as they are?
I know that
I got a neighbor that feeds the deer, and she was warned to stop feeding them, and she keeps on, and that's why I've got deer in my yard.
Aww.
So I think somebody should tell people they aren't supposed to be feeding their deer right on their lawn.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's unfortunate that we have differing opinions, because you not so much with the deer, your neighbor very much with the deer, and that does create a problem for you. Hosta are like salad bar to deer, and I know I've told this story before, but I had a client who said to me, "Oh, Liz, what did you plant? I absolutely love this plant." And I went out to look, as I said, I haven't planted anything new, so let's go out and take a look. And he pointed at hostas that had been there for like 20 years. And I said, "Well, those are the hostas." And he said, "Oh, I thought hostas were those things that look like celery coming out of the ground." Because the deer always ate them, and that year we treated because they were looking so pathetic. And he's like, "Oh, now I get why people like them." But he had embraced that they look like celery coming up out of the ground.
Sure.
And he was so kind, he didn't say, "Please remove that ugly plant out of the yard." But deer are very hard to retrain. Once they have developed a feeding spot, it's very, very hard to retrain them. I would not cut the stems back, because you need that plant to continue to photosynthesize in order to strengthen those roots. And they're going to need that little bit of extra strength because they've been fed on. And so they're going to try and kick up new growth. They're going to pull nutrients out of their roots, et cetera. So don't cut them back. You know, if you have some dead leaves, go ahead and take those out, but then just let them be and let them gather the whatever light they can and whatever they need to actually feed themselves for over winter. There are lots of deer repellents out there. The tough thing is that weather dictates how often you have to apply that. But if you can actually change their habits early in the year by putting out something that is going to repel them, then they may change their feeding path, and maybe you can get them to eat another neighbor's hostas instead of yours. I'm sorry.
Our wildlife expert, Scott Craven, said that deer skid, S-K-Y-D, mm-hmm. he's had wonderful luck with.
Oh, and Scott is the one who mm-hmm. knows this inside out and upside down.
Yeah.
Because the deer have been changing their feeding habits since COVID. I'm going to blame it on COVID.
Sure, why not?
But they are now eating lilacs. They are eating junipers. They are eating, I had them eat hellebores. I have had them eat things, lavender, things that normally they don't like and they don't eat. And that is what's going on. So we're all kind of in uncharted territory here with what the deer are doing.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
All right, thanks, Laurel. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, you are next. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to offer hope to the woman with her hostas whose neighbor is feeding deer. We learned about it's called Scarecrow. That's a brand name. I'm sure that there are other ones available. But what it is it's an electric, you hook it up to your garden hose, and it has an electric eye
mm-hmm.
that is battery operated.
Yep.
And when the beam is broken, it goes.
Wonderful
and
suggestion.
Starts spraying water. And we learned about this from a woman who lives on the Lake Michigan shore, and there's deer all, it's a wooded area, and there's deer all over the place, and they never could grow hosta. They never could grow, there are a whole bunch of plants they never could grow. they, when they learned about this, they put one at each end of their house.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their garden just did beautifully all summer. And in the fall, when they turned them off because of the potential of freezing, that night everything disappeared.
Yep. Yep. It is a great suggestion. People use that for geese as well, for Canada geese, when they want to kind of have them move on. So oftentimes people around shores will put that out for the Canada geese also. I had one suggestion Scott had made to me 1,000 years ago, and it was fishing line at about chest height, and then you tie something to it that moves. So whether that's ribbon or whatever, that seems to be a blind spot for the deer. And so if something moves all the time, then they aren't going to go through it. And that's all I use to go around my vegetable garden, are two rows of that, one at about knee height and one at about chest height, because I figure they might, if it's a short one, it'll go underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And that works really well. I still get a couple that come through. Somebody will jump over the wire or the fishing line, but that does work. But you have to be a little careful about where you put that, because you don't want to decapitate anyone.
Right.
So you have to be careful that it's not a traffic pattern for humans.
Sure. Well, that's definitely a different way to go, for mm-hmm. sure. Jim emailed us a picture. He says it's blue plumbago. And it was a nice surprise because it was given to him 3 summers ago as an annual in a pot. And he loved it and brought it in for the winter. And this is 3 years later, and he didn't realize it was a large southern shrub.
It is. And that is, it's a gorgeous picture.
It's
reminiscent of, the flowers are reminiscent of a phlox.
Yes.
And I'm glad he's taking it in and out. It's not hardy for us here. We do have one that's similar. It's called plumbago. It's called creeping plumbago. And it's Ceratostigma plumbagonoides. And it was not thought to be hardy for us, but it is. And that one I didn't put on here because it's really limited. I know up to not quite Madison, I've had it survive, but nothing north of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it blooms now. And it gets a little bit of red color on the leaves for fall.
Oh.
So it is a really good one, a nice ground cover, not horribly invasive. But that is a beautiful, beautiful plumbago picture he sent.
And the color is gorgeous.
Beautiful.
It's like a periwinkle, a light periwinkle. It's just gorgeous.
With nice little dark lines through it. It's really, really, really wonderful. And good job on overwintering that. Good job.
That's right. Way to go, Jim.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go to Patricia in Antigo. Go right ahead.
Hi. I really like the show, but I have some hazelnut bushes. One's 4 years old, got chewed up a little the first winter because I didn't know to protect it from the bunnies and so forth.
Mm.
But the other one's a couple years old, and they have not bloomed at all, and I'm wondering if there's, if I just have to wait.
Yeah.
Or
Patience. How tall are they now?
Well, one's the older one's like 4 feet tall.
Okay.
I mean, it looks pretty healthy,
mm-hmm.
funny leaves and everything. The younger one's maybe two or three feet tall.
Okay. And have you checked them to see if any nuts developed while you weren't watching?
Yeah, I check them pretty regularly.
Okay.
I thought they have catkins.
Yep.
I think, or
they do.
Yeah,
they
see anything like that.
Yeah, they send off catkins in the spring, and then you'll see these clusters of really, they look like sputniks, like clusters of sputniks, and the hazelnuts are on the inside of those. And you have to beat the wildlife to get the nuts, because if you miss one day, most of it will be gone. And that's for shrubs. I want to say it took about 5 years to get fruit on mine, to get the nuts on mine, on the shrubs. It took 11 years to get hazelnuts on my tree. And then it seems like it's going to be every other year instead of every year. And so be patient. Oftentimes with fruiting and nut bearing, it does take longer than what we expect. And especially if you've got a smaller one that might only have been a couple years old, you may have a few more years before you get something. But don't worry, if you see those catkins, you will see nuts, and then just beat the critters to it and you'll enjoy it. The shrubs tend to produce smaller hazelnuts unless you got a cultivar that was bred for big hazelnuts, but they're delicious. The ones out of the yard are even more delicious than what you buy in the store.
Now, she's an antico, and mm-hmm. those do really well all the way up, don't
it's
they?
It's a native. Mm-hmm. It's a native for us. It's something that tolerates an awful lot of cold, so we have no worries about that.
Mm-hmm. What do they look like in the fall? Do they get color?
They get color, but they're not what I would call an outstandingly colored shrub.
Sure.
They're interesting. They have nice habit. It's really an easy shrub to take care of. So it's nice, but it's not one that's on my color list.
Gotcha. All right. Let's go to Jeannie in Wisconsin Rabbits next. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in Wisconsin Rapids, central Wisconsin. There's a lot of perennials in my yard, and we are moving to Colorado, and we're thinking of moving in March. Is there any way to pull some perennials and do any preparation for transporting bare root until I can plant them out there?
You may not even want to consider bare root depending on what you have for travel space. You may want to dig some of those up in like later this month. I would wait until we're past the heat. I don't know what you guys have for heat, but it's been exceedingly hot. And you might want to give them a little bit of time to bring those night temperatures down so that you've got a plant that isn't super stressed out. But put them in pots. Put them in pots and start taking care of them now. Then put them into a garage or an outbuilding for the winter. And you probably will lose some, but I think you're going to be better off than trying to do bare root, because bare root requires specific humidities and storage conditions in order to do really well. So unless you have that, I would say digging them, potting them, and giving that your effort is probably an easier and more successful way to go. If you're moving in March, depending on what kind of a winter we have, you might be able to wait until March to actually dig those up and then just dig them up. At that point, they could go into bags, you know, plastic bags instead of pots, which will save you on storage space for moving. But that is going to be kind of a bit of a that's a bit of a crapshoot because we don't know what the winter is going to be like. You can in February, if that's a direction you want to go, you can in February, possibly when we've got not as much snow on the ground, put some straw or something down over the areas you want to dig. And that way it will start to moderate and maybe heat it up a little bit. And so if it is frozen, you might still be able to get into it. And one could argue you could do that now, but then you may have rodents move into it. I don't know that that's definitely a way to go.
Okay, well, good luck with that, Jeannie. You know, the last couple minutes we have before we break, we've got one vine on your list.
And it's one that I'm going to get pushback on.
Uh-oh. Go for it.
It's the Clematis, the Sweet Autumn. A lot of the Clematis will be in flower now, and some of them, Summer Love actually is looking pretty good right now, and that is some breeding that was done off of this Sweet Autumn Clematis. And it's one that people say, yeah, but it gets out of control. It does. But it doesn't spread roots. You know, it's not like you're going to get plants all over. It's just that it grows very, very well for us, and enjoy that and take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. And it creates a beautiful, beautiful backdrop for, you know, something else in front of it. And so embrace it. Yes, I know some people don't like it. They think it's horrible and it's low class, blah, blah, blah. It does the job. It's white, it smells good, and it's flowering. So
yeah,
there you go.
I think they're beautiful. It reminds me of like a bridal veil mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So
and really? It's great in the moonlight. We tend to forget about gardens at night. Mm-hmm. And so you pick stuff that is going to glow in the moon. So light pinks and whites glow
sure.
in the moon.
Yeah. And you could probably mix it in with some moonflower.
Absolutely. Who doesn't love a moonflower?
Yeah. Gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Easy to grow, too.
Mm-hmm.
That would be on the annual side.
It would. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we come back after this look at the news, we're going to talk about some annuals and some perennials. And of course, we'll continue to take your calls and emails. So stay with us because Liz will be back. Thanks. ¶¶ Well, this is Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us. Our guest is gardening expert Liz Fremont. She is a provider of concierge horticulture services through her business, The Garden Hoe. And she's happy to help you with any of your gardening questions. So give us a call. We still have a couple of lines open, 800-642-1234. And you can always send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Liz, let's go right to the phone. So you have Andrea and Madison. Thanks for waiting, Andrea.
Hi. I just wanted to reiterate that the sweet autumn clematis is very vigorous and will romp all over the place. But this can be used for fun if you are into training it. I run it up posts, and last year I made a bower over my deck of the clematis. And, you know, if you've ever wanted to have being entirely a room basically defined by clematis flowers, you can do that with the sweet autumn clematis. Just means you have to get up on a ladder every once in a while, tie it in.
Or train it lower, right?
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Andrea. I love it. Is that kind of like,
how wonderful,
like hop vines?
A little bit. It won't get as tall as hop vines, but it is extremely vigorous once it gets established.
Sure.
And you know, we have native clematis that are similar, but they do not flower as beautifully as the sweet autumn. So yeah, thanks though. That it's always good to hear people are playing with their plants.
Yeah, I love that. Christina in Glenwood, you are up next.
Hi there, thank you. I have a healthy flowering crab that has suckers growing on the side of the trunk, and then also those small branches that you want to take off so that the canopy grows well. And I'm wondering, is it safe to do that now, or should I wait until winter?
You could do either. If it's easier for you to do it now, now is a halfway decent time to do anything that's fruiting. And so you should be fine to go ahead and cut off some of those branches. Just wait until it gets not quite as, you know, the humidity level goes down a little bit, because you want those cuts to heal over as quickly as possible. You don't need to put any treatment on them. It's just pick a nice dry day so that when you go and cut that off, it's going to heal over in minutes as opposed to hours, and that minimizes the impact of any pathogens or insects that might get at them while they're open. I know Brian's recommendation is always to wait until winter because he sees diseases everywhere he goes, and so it's preventative mode for him. But you are safe to do it. Now is an okay time to do that. We still have enough time that if it does develop any new growth, depending on how long fall goes, that it should be enough to harden off. Once we get toward the end of August, I really hesitate to cut anything off because we're at that in-between time where it might regrow, and then if we get early cold weather, that will freeze off that new growth. And so you can actually create more potential damage if you don't time it properly. But, you know, if you do that this week, next week, you should be okay.
What other flowering bushes like lilacs and, you know, things like that? Too late?
No. Yes and no. I mean, you can prune lilacs at any point in time, and normally they'll be fine. Again, follow good practices. If you're cutting into diseased tissue, always disinfect your equipment in between cuts so that you're not transferring anything that's either on the outside or the inside of that plant to another area. So you want to be careful about that. And anything that's broken or dead, always take it off. Just, you know, please, because that's just more points for diseases and pathogens to get into. Lilacs, though, if you cut them now, you're going to cut the blooms off. They're already set. Rule of thumb, again, rule of thumb, always broken somewhere by somebody, some plant somewhere, is within about 6 weeks of something flowering, if it's spring flowering, if you cut it back at that point, you're not going to impact the flower buds too horribly much. You wait until now and you're going to cut the buds off. But if it's a choice of I can either cut it now or I can't cut it until never, then go ahead and do it. And just accept you're going to lose some of the blossoms. Mm-hmm. That's all.
All right, perfect. Well, we didn't get a chance to talk about annuals and perennials yet.
Mm.
So let's kind of pick out some of your top annuals. And again, can we pick these up at the gardening, nurseries
yep.
right now?
Yep.
Okay.
I took out, well, you maybe even not now, but you okay. might be able to in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Most garden centers, if you know what you want for next year and they don't have it in stock, if you tell them about it now, they can often get it ordered for you and it will be there in the spring for when you want it. Some of the things that you can find right now that we have to be a little cautious of are mums, coneflowers, and
asters, probably.
Asters also, that you can put those things in the ground, but you may not get them to survive over winter.
Terrible luck with that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And right now the coneflowers are looking fabulous in the garden center, so we buy them to pop them in. No, take your pen and paper or your phone, however you take your notes, jot down which cultivar you liked, put it on your I'm going to buy it early next spring list, and then go get it in the spring. And the reason I say that is that coneflowers have roots that take a long time to develop. And if you put them in now, it probably won't make it through winter. The same thing with mums. It takes them longer than while they're flowering. And they're producing flowers, so all of their energy is going into flower production, meaning you're getting slower root growth. So you try and put that in the ground now, and we have a shortfall. No, it's not going to happen. Now, this last year, we didn't have as much overwintering, as I do have a friend that buys them every year in the fall and then pops them into the ground, and sometimes they survive. And she knows that. Sometimes they survive, sometimes they don't. Last year they didn't. Year before they did, because we had snow cover. Mums like moisture, but they don't like it on their crown, and they like it very specifically. And if it insulates it, they will stay okay for the winter. But like last year, no. It wasn't enough for them.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so, I mean, there are some that, yeah, they look good, but I don't know that I would put them in right now.
Sure. We do have a phone call from Lee in Green Bay. Go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like your thoughts on when would be a good time to start moving, and we'll call them wild evergreens, white pines, balsam. When's a good time to start? I know I wouldn't do it in this heat.
Yeah, that I don't do. That I leave to the tree people. And what I would do is I would call if you popped it into Google, it would tell you when you could pop them out of the ground. Too hot, you're absolutely right. I think that, I'm going to go, I don't know. I really, because anything I'm going to tell you, I'm going to pull out of the gray recesses, and that's not good. I will tell you what I do when I want to know when to dig a tree. I call Chad of Johnson's Nursery, and I say, are you guys digging? And what are you digging? And that's how I find out whether I should be digging or not, because they pay close attention to what the weather conditions are, what the soil conditions are, and what the tree conditions are. So if it's a small tree, I would say you're probably, and we're talking like 2 feet or less, you're probably going to be okay to do it as soon as it's not quite so hot. And then get that planted, either transplanted or what have you. If you're going to go late in the year, just make sure, again, to put some mulch down after the ground freezes solid so that you're protecting that root zone. And the reason why you do that to protect the root zone is not to keep it warm, because mulch only moderates at a couple of degrees. What you're doing is you're moderating moisture and you're moderating temperature even just that few degrees so that it doesn't heave when we freeze and thaw the early parts of the season and in the late parts of the season. So that's going to give that root a chance to stay put without the ground, you know, bouncing up and down around it. So mm-hmm. that's why you do that. But, you know, we've planted things as late as January. We've planted trees as late as January, and it really just depends on when they're dug and how they were taken care of.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm going to give you the you stumped me today.
Got the award.
You got it.
I've had really good luck digging up wild evergreens mm-hmm. really early spring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, depends on the soil, depends on the spot, depends mm-hmm. on the tree, because certain trees have got different time periods
sure.
where they're like, don't bother me.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well, good luck, Lee. Experiment if they're
us know how you do with
if
that.
If they're free and wild, what mm-hmm. the heck? As long as they're on your property now.
that's right. Don't go to the neighbors.
Please yeah. don't do that. We're the national forest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's get back to our list, Liz.
Okay.
What other ones do we want to pick out here in the last few minutes?
You know what I love is I love Senna. I think I put that on your list, and that is flowering right now. That is a native, and it's in the legume. It's a legume of sorts, and it's got beautiful leaves, gorgeous goldy yellow flowers, and a bit tall, so it's something toward the back, but it's unusual.
And it's Senna with an S,
yes,
and it's a perennial.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, we have Helenium, which is another good one for fall. It responds similarly. Actually, I'm going to talk about two of them. I mean, we talk about Helenium and then Vernonia also. Not Veronica, but Vernonia.
I wondered if that was a typo, and then I'm like, oh, no, there is a Veronia.
There
okay.
is a Vernonia. And the Vernonia and the Helenium are both late season flowering plants. What I love about them is it doesn't require you to learn anything new on how to take care of a plant. So these are fall flowering. If you want them to be shorter with, you know, little shorter blooms, because some Vernonia can be up to about 10 feet tall.
Oh my gosh.
They have cultivars that are knee high and waist high. And sometimes if it's just a little too big for the spot, I have found that they respond well to trimming like you do a mum. So you go in and you trim them a few times before the 4th of July and they'll branch out and you'll still get the beautiful flowers. Helenium is really interesting in that it is a very adaptable plant. It will tolerate flooding. It will tolerate drought. And it has beautiful daisy-like, similar to Gallardia, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And reds, oranges, a little bit of yellow out there, but they are great. They're easy. The flowers are probably 2 to 3 inches across.
Oh,
and
wow.
They've been doing some good breeding on those. And late season, you know, I don't see a lot of pollinators around them. But I think that has to do more with when, as far as when I'm there and looking.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another one in the perennial category that we should talk about is, I don't think I put it on the list, or maybe I did, Calamantha. I did not. Calamantha.
Yes, you did.
Did I put it on there? Okay. Calamantha. There it is. Yeah.
Liz is looking on her phone. So.
Yeah. Because I didn't memorize it. I put together a list and then I handed it over. Calamantha is related to Nepeta, to mint, and it is one of those plants that from June until like 3 hard freezes, this plant goes gangbusters.
Yeah.
And Montrose White is interesting. White, I think there's one called White Cloud. There's one that has a bit of a blue tinge to it. The native has a bit of a blue tinge to it. But they're really quite interesting in how many bees they attract for pollinating.
I have some, and
yeah.
You're right. It's flowers the entire season,
it's
basically.
Wonderful.
I bought 3, and I mm-hmm. could have gotten away with 1. It really gets big.
Yes, it does.
But I love it. It's gorgeous.
Some of them, now, some of the species types, they'll flop a little bit, and
mm-hmm.
if they don't get enough light, they'll flop a bit. So you do need to have those in full sun.
Mm-hmm.
But they are extremely adaptable beyond that. You can kind of throw anything at them and they'll just love it. That one is, if you only want one pollinator plant for your fall garden, that will do it. Mm-hmm. That will do it.
It pollinators, bees all the time on it.
It's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. So mm-hmm. that one is a great plant. Mums, you can't go wrong with. Dianthus, though, really, some of the dianthus right now are looking so fantastic. And mm-hmm. if you have sandy soil, dianthus actually does really pretty well. It will take sharp drainage. And so as long as there's moisture there and not dry like dune sand, and even at that, you could probably get away with some of them. Mm-hmm. There are some that will get extremely, extremely tall stems on them. Light, tiny flowers, they're beautiful. So there's a lot of fun to be had there.
What about foliage, Liz? What are some of the nice perennials that the foliage are important? Mm. Anything?
I did put Ceratostigma on here. Yeah, that one has got good foliage. I would say, I mean, Eupatorium has got pretty good foliage on it. That, especially if you go with tall Jopi, mm-hmm. Yeah, that has got outstanding architectural interest to it.
And they get some very tall, don't they?
They do, mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are the breeding that they've been doing on the white flowering and red leafed are beautiful.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. Those things are lovely. So you have white, kind of creamy white, and almost a purpley red foliage, which is wonderful. The sedums, we cannot discount the sedums. There are so many gorgeous, gorgeous series out there. Yeah. The Dazzleberry series is nice. There's, it's got great foliage, great bright flowers, and, you know, there's all kinds of sedum out there for almost everything. Doesn't have to just be autumn joy. And there's nothing wrong with autumn joy.
It's a beautiful plant.
It is. It's absolutely beautiful. For a shade garden, Tricertis is also a good one. Now, a little bit further up north, you may have trouble growing that one. It's called toad lily, and it has small orchid-like looking flowers on it. And they're doing some really wonderful breeding work on that, too, to have them stand up a little bit more upright because they typically will lean slightly one way or the other. Yeah. But that one is good for shade garden. Heuchera always looks really good in the fall, and then not so much the rest of the year, but this is its season. Mm-hmm. So there's tons of leaf color on the heuchera.
Okay.
Everything from a vibrant chartreuse green to almost black purple. And so there's anything and everything in the color range on those. Mm-hmm. Dan Hinckley out of the West Coast has been doing breeding on those for a number of years, and it does a beautiful job. I think I got the right guy for that. Let's see, what else do we like? Sunflowers also are great. We have the native sunflowers. We have all kinds of interesting stuff with those. But, you know, I want to look at some of the annuals, if we could, because moonflower you mentioned, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And that you can do from seed easily. And they come out at night. They're massive blooms, and they're just happy. That sit down with a cup of tea at the, you know, at night and just look at the moonflowers. Mm-hmm. They're wonderful. Or whatever beverage. This is Wisconsin. It could be a...
anything.
Could be a bloody. We don't know. Zinnias also for this time of the year. I mean, that's another one that's super easy that you can do with kids. So sunflowers and not the perennial ones, but the annual sunflowers. That zinnias you can do with kids. They're very satisfying because they pop up right away. Mm-hmm. And State Fair is one of my favorite zinnias for cutting. You sometimes have to stake them depending on how they, you know, how fast they grow at whatever particular time. But they grow with long enough stems that you can use them as cut flowers very, very well. And that one has got decent sized flowers and will be probably on me chest height. You know, so they're really quite tall. There's everything from short to super tall. Ornamental kales, too. Don't forget those now.
They're beautiful. Yeah. They really are. Cindy from Janesville emailed us a picture. She said the insects are loving her cone flowers.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah. And this is the first year that Cindy learned how to prune them to encourage additional flowering. Mm. The same with her Shasta daisies. What are your thoughts about pruning perennials like that?
Absolutely. You will find a couple of different opinions on it. There are some people who say do not ever prune the flowers off because you're impacting the food for the wildlife. Mm. Yeah, okay, but that's one flower. When you prune them properly, you get repeat bloom. So what you're looking at doing in my world is you prune off, you deadhead where the flowers that do need to be deadheaded. Some don't like it when you do that, but those that do need deadheading and you're promoting more flowers, you're actually just providing more food down the road. Mm-hmm. So doing that early, good idea. Once we get closer to winter, I don't ever clean up a garden other than peonies in the fall, because those stems on those plants provide homes for beneficial insects. So if you cut those off, so this goes to the, are we promoting wildlife? Are we promoting pollination, et cetera? Well, we want those beneficial insects to actually stay in the yard. So if you provide stems where they can overwinter, awesome. And then it's, okay, what is the time frame for cutting them off? Well, when you start to see insect activity in the spring, then you can cut those off. And that, to me, is a good way to just multiply the benefits of your garden.
And it looks nice in the winter when it's so stark out. Mm-hmm. And when you trim in the spring, do you let your those things lie in
yep.
the beds?
Oh, it depends on the client. There are some that don't like anything in the beds, and so they will get removed. But no, normally it's just I let the debris be where it is, because as long as it isn't going to create a mushy, rotten sort of thing. I mean, if you have 4 inches of flower heads, you know, you might not want to do that. You might want to spread them out or put them in the compost pile.
Yeah.
But if it's a look that bothers someone, then yes, it'll go in a bucket, then it'll go in the compost pile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's what I usually just let mine stay right where they are, because that's what nature would provide.
Well, and when you look at things like marigolds, you really should work the heads and the plants back into the soil, because they have properties that will control soil nematodes, and often those are not beneficial nematodes. So it doesn't do just to plant that marigold and have the roots do the job. Mm-hmm. You just, in winter, just let it lay, and in spring, pop it into the ground, and it does its work.
All right. Well, Liz, this went by so fast.
It did,
Thank
as
you
always.
So much for being with us and sharing all of that knowledge. It's amazing.
That's my pleasure. I so enjoy it.
Good. Our guest has been Liz Fremont. She's a provider of concierge horticulture services through her business, The Garden Hoe. Stay with us. We are going to be talking about combining flowers for good and bad, and also about picking peppers. When should Peter Piper pick those peppers to pickle? Well, our next guest has the answer. This is Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And joining us for the first time is Lauren Landers. She's a master gardener, a writer, public speaker with over a decade of experience helping others learn about gardening, homesteading, and sustainable living. And you can find more on her blog, Zero Waste Homestead. Besides those peppers, we'll talk to her about what plants don't do well when they're planted together. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Join in with your questions by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Lauren. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
You bet. So I think a lot of people are in the position right now where those peppers are looking pretty good in the garden, but how do I know when to pick them? What's your advice for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. We definitely are approaching pepper harvest season right now. So it really kind of varies depending on the types of peppers you're growing, from bell peppers to spicy jalapenos.
Okay.
So the first place to start would definitely be to look at your seed packets, because, like I said, it varies depending on the type of peppers. Most seed packets will say it's about 70 to 85 days from the point of growing peppers from seed until harvesting. But that really varies depending on the type. And something like a Carolina Reaper, which is a super hot pepper, might take 150 days. until it's ready to harvest, but that's just one way to really tell. And they're, because a lot of things can vary depending on how the pepper is grown, the type of weather you're having, how much heat you're having, and that sort of thing.
Sure. Can you tell by looking at it?
Definitely. Days to harvest is just one piece of information, but a better way to judge is just to look at it. So the fun thing about peppers is they can be harvested anytime they reach a usable size. You can pick them when they're green or when they reach the ripen color. A lot of people don't realize that peppers will continue to develop color as they ripen. So there's a few things that you can look at. One is the size, if they're a usable size, but then the other thing is the color. So something like a jalapeno actually turns red when it's fully ripe, but they're usually harvested when they're green. Bell peppers can be picked when they're green, but a lot of bell peppers will turn yellow, orange, red, or even purple when they're fully ripe, and that really depends on the type of pepper you're growing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about the flavor, the hotness for those hot chilies and whatnot? The greener they are, the hotter they are, or the redder they are, the hotter they are? Does that work?
That's a good question. So it's actually, you're going to get sweeter and hotter peppers if you let them develop more color. But for something with a jalapeno, like a jalapeno, you're going to want to get it right when it's turning from green to red. That's the maximum heat level. They actually become sweeter as they turn fully red, and they lose some of the capsaicin content, which is what makes them hot. So you want to get jalapenos when they're green to red. Something like a habanero, you're going to want to wait till it reaches the mature color of orange. Like a banana pepper is hottest when it's yellow, bright yellow. So it really depends on what the mature color is supposed to look like.
And the color, I mean, even on bell pepper, the taste of a green one compared to, you know, when it gets red, yellow, what have you, is definitely different.
Right, yeah. So you're going to get a sweeter bell pepper if you pick when it is, whatever the mature color for the bell pepper you're harvesting. And something I like to do just to get, like, the most color and taste variety with my bell peppers is I'll harvest them when they're green and then freeze those and then wait for them to develop more color and then pick them at different stages of the ripening process. You get more colors but also more flavor variety.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And so when you plant your peppers, do you keep that in mind, that you'll be harvesting them as they go?
Yeah, and it might be helpful for some people just to kind of mark on their calendars when you put your peppers in the ground so you can kind of get an idea of when the harvest season is going to start, and then you can kind of plan when you're planning to harvest. And if you're growing a lot of peppers at once and you want to do some freezing, just kind of having that planned out too. And you can also get peppers a lot earlier if you start with nursery starts rather than seed, if that's a goal.
Sure, absolutely. Well, one of the other reasons we asked you to stop by and talk to us today, Lauren, was we were going to talk about companion planting, kind of in the opposite of what we normally hear. But why don't you describe what companion planting is and what are some of the benefits of that?
Yeah, companion planting is one of my favorite topics to talk about. It's just so interesting, and I think more and more people are kind of realizing the value of companion planting. It's a really great thing to include if you're an organic gardener because it offers just a lot of benefits to your organic garden, or if you're growing conventionally, it's just a great tool to have in your gardening arsenal. So companion planting in the basic concept is just growing certain plants that get along well together to, in close proximity. And it has a lot of benefits. One of the main reasons why people do this is for pest control. So some plants will naturally repel pests, like something like a scented herb can keep pests from coming near your vegetables. But a lot of companion plants, especially ones with flowers, will also attract beneficial insects that will feed on garden pests. So that's one of the main reasons why people do companion planting, but some companion plants can also improve the growth or flavor of their neighbors. A good example of that would be basil combined with tomatoes. Legumes, which is beans and peas, can improve, can add nutrients to the soil. So you can actually reduce your need for fertilizers if you're growing those with companion plants. Plants can also provide shade, support, and trellising, or even be used as a mulch if you're growing something like a ground cover. So those just some of the main benefits of companion plants.
Right. Now, those are some good combos, but we can assume that there are bad combinations of plants. What are some of the things that can happen if we put incompatible plants together?
Yeah, so a lot of plants do really well together, and there's just, you know, a few companion plant pairings that just don't really go well together. And a lot of this comes down to plants not having the same growing condition needs. So if you grow something that needs a lot of sun or a lot of water near something that likes shade or drier soil, you're going to be one of those plants is going to be struggling very likely. You can also have problems if you grow aggressive plants together, like something like a mint can easily choke out other plants. There's also some plants like heavy feeding corn can compete with other plants for nutrients or space. And one of the main things that can happen is if you're growing plants that are closely related together, they can potentially increase pest problems or disease problems in your garden or even cross-pollinate. And then the final issue that can happen is something called allelopathy, and that is when some plants can actually suppress the growth of their neighbors. They secrete things into the soil that actually make other plants kind of struggle. So
sure.
Something to be aware of.
Well, let's talk about some of those bad combinations. Now, I saw you wrote a great article for Better Homes and Gardens, and you called out some of these combinations. So let's talk about some of those. The first one you had on your list was fennel, and it's not really, it doesn't like to share, does it?
It doesn't. It is one of the worst neighbors you can grow in your vegetable garden. That is one of the plants that is allelopathic to other plants, so it will actually suppress the growth of other plants nearby. And fennel does this to reduce plant competition, so it has more space to grow, but it can really affect growth of neighboring plants. So I always grow fennel in pots kind of near my garden because it's a great pollinator plant. And, you know, I like to harvest it for my own use, but I keep it directly out of my vegetable beds just because it can just be a hard one.
And I had never heard that. So I was really surprised about that one, but it does make a lot of sense. So next we have our brassicas and strawberries. Now, brassicas, of course, are cauliflower, cabbage. What am I missing? Broccoli?
Kale,
okay.
Yeah, collard greens.
Yeah, and strawberries. Now, thinking just the thought of those two together, like in my mouth, it's like, ew. But they're, other than that, I mean, what are some of the reasons why we don't want to put them together?
Well, at first glance, that might seem like an okay pairing in the garden because they both like rich soil and a lot of water. But the main reason why you want to keep those two apart is because of pest issues. They tend to attract the same pests, and specifically cabbage loopers, which are tiny little caterpillars that really kind of flock to brassica plants. And if you have strawberries nearby, these cabbage loopers are going to hop on over to your strawberries and kind of ruin your strawberry crop too. So you just want to space those apart if you can.
For sure. Now, are there some things that do go well with brassicas?
Yeah, so brassicas, one of the best things to grow near them are alliums, which are garlic, onions, chives, anything in the onion family, because these alliums have naturally sulfur properties that they secrete, and they can actually make your brassicas more pest resistant. You can also grow something like a bean or pea in your brassicas because the legumes fix nitrogen into the soil, which helps brassicas grow better. So it's like a natural fertilizer.
Okay.
Whereas strawberries kind of grow well with lettuce or rhubarb, just a nice little pairing.
Oh, I've never thought about strawberries and rhubarb, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, great for pies.
Yeah, true. Absolutely. Well, that's kind of true with some of these combos that work, right? Is they taste good together, kind of like the basil and the tomatoes, right?
Yeah. That's maybe why they were paired together in the kitchen in the first place.
Probably. Now, here's another one that is not such a great pair. It's the cucumber and sage. Now, why should we separate these two?
So the main reason why you want to keep those apart is watering issues. So cucumbers like a lot of water. You can kind of tell that by how much water the fruit contains.
Sure.
But sage is a Mediterranean herb. It does best in sandy, dry soil. So if you're growing those two together, there's a good chance that your cucumbers are either going to be underwatered or your sage is going to be overwatered and develop root rot. So you kind of want to stick sage with plants that prefer drier conditions. Sage also grows really well with brassicas just for a pest control standpoint, whereas cucumbers, a great one for them is his dill, like we were saying. These taste pairings paired well together, but then dill also helps keep the pests off cucumber plants.
You know, my grandfather always planted dill with his cucumbers, and yeah, apparently he knew what he was doing.
yeah, smart.
Then we've got asparagus and alliums, which I think would be interesting to put those together. I think I guess I wouldn't have thought about it, but that's probably a good thing because they don't do well together.
Yeah, so finding plants that grow well with asparagus can be a little tricky because it's a slow-growing plant. It takes about 3 years to start producing spears, but you have to keep the asparagus fronds in place until then. So a lot of people tuck different vegetables in around asparagus plants, but alliums is just one you don't want to put in your asparagus bed, largely because alliums actually inhibit the growth of asparagus, so your asparagus plants are just not going to grow as well with alliums nearby. But because both of these are root crops, they can also compete with each other for soil space. And then when you go and harvest your onions, you could potentially also be disturbing your asparagus crown.
Oh, sure. Now, when you say close together, what are you talking about? A foot, 5 feet, 10 feet?
A foot or two of asparagus. So, like, a lot of these companion plant pairings, you can still grow these plants in your garden, mm-hmm. but you're going to want to space them out. I would recommend spacing them at least 2 to 3 feet apart, maybe putting a row of vegetable buffer in between. So grow something like a lettuce in between your onions and asparagus would be enough to separate that. Whereas something potatoes and tomatoes that can share the same pest, you want to kind of spread those out even further in your garden, maybe put them on opposite sides of the bed.
Oh, sure. Great. Our guest on Garden Talk today is Lauren Landers. She's a master gardener, writer, and public speaker. What questions do you have about companion planting? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry today. And join us next week on Garden Talk. We're going to get some advice from UW Extension horticulturist Vijay Pandian. And then Susan Carpenter from the UW Arboretum is going to be in to talk about some great upcoming native plant classes. Right now, we are talking to Lauren Landers about some combinations of plants that don't do so great together. We just talked about asparagus and alliums. Don't do it. Up next, we're talking about corn and tomatoes. Now, that was a surprise for me. I thought those two would get together well. What's the problem there, Lauren?
Yeah, so corn and tomatoes are both really heavy feeding plants. So growing those two together can deplete your soil faster and increase the amount of fertilizer you need to use. But these plants also attract the same pest. It's called corn earworms on corn, but it's also known as tomato fruit worms on tomatoes. It's the same pest, but if you grow these two plants together, you're going to increase the pest problems in both of your plants.
Okay, we had talked about putting basil with tomatoes as a good combination. Mm-hmm. What about corn? Can we put anything with corn?
Yeah, one of the most classic examples of companion planting is actually with corn. It's known as the Three Sisters planting method. It's created by the indigenous community, and this is you're pairing corn with pole beans, which is a climbing vining bean, and winter squash. So the corn serves as a natural trellis for the climbing bean, and the bean improves the soil with nitrogen, while the winter squash around the base of these two plants serves as a natural mulch to insulate the soil, and also because winter squash has prickly leaves can keep something like a raccoon from eating your corn. It's great. Method.
Yeah, that is we can definitely look to indigenous people for really good advice when it comes to
Absolutely.
Gardens, right? Have you grown the Three Sisters yourself?
I have. It did work well. I personally used purple potted pole beans, which I think I always have a really good success rate with them actually climbing up corn. So, and then I did some winter squash around the base, and I definitely noticed that they did better in that pairing.
That's great. I love that. So next up, excuse me, you have dill and carrots. Now, those are in the same family, right?
Yes, they are. They are both umbellifer plants, and that is kind of the reason why these two plants don't grow well together. One, because they're closely related enough that they can actually cross-pollinate with each other, which is mainly a problem if you're planning to collect your own seeds, because you can end up with seeds that just are not going to be tasty. But these two plants can also attract the same pests. So you're going to potentially end up with more carrot fly problems if you keep dill near your carrot, because the dill is actually going to attract more carrot flies.
So the dill goes great with cucumbers. What about carrots then? Is there something that works well with them?
Yeah, so growing sage near carrots can actually reduce carrot fly problems. Carrots also grow really well with radishes, which is something I personally like to do, because the radishes sprout a little faster than carrots, which can break up the soil and make it easier for carrot seeds to germinate.
That is an awesome idea, because we do get little short carrots a lot of the times, don't we?
Yeah.
Is that generally because the ground is too hard?
Usually, yes. There's a few things that can make small carrots. It could be the soil is too hard. It can be lack of water, not enough sun, or just not enough nutrients from the soil.
Okay. And then we've got grapes and cabbage. Now, I would never consider putting those two together, but obviously somebody tried it. So what happens when those two get together?
Yeah, so that is not just cabbage. Any brassicas really just don't do well with grapes. And a lot of that has to do with they're just heavy feeding plants, and they're going to compete with each other. Specifically, the brassicas are just not going to get enough nutrients really under a grapevine. So you're probably going to end up with undersized crops. With that, I would definitely recommend doing grapevines more with like a flower or some herbs, because those plants don't need as much fertilizer. And alliums and celery actually go really well with cabbage and other brassicas.
Oh, sure. That makes sense with that one. And we were talking about, you know, corn and tomatoes earlier, but what about potatoes and tomatoes?
Yeah, so these are both nightshades, and at first glance, you might think they should grow well together because they have the same basic needs and they're the same family, but this plant pairing doesn't work mostly because of pest issues. These plants both attract the same pests, like cornworms and potato beetles, and they're both heavy feeders, so if you keep them too close together, you're likely to end up with more pest problems and also maybe a smaller crop because they're both competing for soil nutrients.
And next we've got rue and basil. Now talk about rue, because that's something that we don't grow too much of. What's it, right. What is it used for?
Yeah. So this is a lesser common, companion plant pairing. Rue is often used, now as a ornamental plant. It has beautiful kind of feathery bluish green leaves. And it's also a great pollinator plant. You're more likely to see it in something like an ornamental garden, but it's also traditionally used as a medicinal plant. But it just does not grow well with basil. These two plants can actually inhibit each other's growth. So if you have basil, you'll just want to keep it far away from your rue.
That is just amazing. Did you learn all this through trial and error, or do you have great reference sources?
A little bit of both. I have had a number of years to experiment in my garden, so I definitely have tried some of these pairings to my detriment. But I've also, there's some great resources on like Cooperative Extension websites for your local university that can list out like charts of just companion plant pairings to avoid.
And there are some good books out there too, so you can check that out as well. So we're talking with Lauren Landers. If you've got any questions about companion planting or vegetable questions, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And the last one on your list, this is a top 11, I think it was, right? Turnips with other root vegetables. Why don't they go together?
Some of this has to do with some root vegetables are going to have the same basic pests. So keeping some root vegetables together can increase pest problems. But also some root vegetables are going to also be competing with each other for soil space. And turnips is a big one because they're kind of one of the larger root vegetables. So you kind of want to space them out more. This is not a hard, fast rule because, like I said, I like growing carrots and radishes together. But you just want to make sure you're really following proper spacing guidelines on these and making sure you enrich your soil with compost or your fertilizer of choice before you're growing them so they have enough nutrients.
And there's a lot of information on those seed packets, aren't there?
Yes, there is. You can definitely find spacing recommendations and planting recommendations on Seed Packet.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your blog? You're a homesteader, right?
I am. Yeah. So I started my homestead in 2018, and then I started the blog soon thereafter, kind of just to document the process of a beginning homesteader, as I learned kind of through trial and error what I was doing or doing wrong sometimes. Since then, Zero Waste Homestead has kind of evolved, includes some homesteading stuff, some canning recipes and gardening recipes, but I've also moved more into the rewilding world and pollinator gardening. So there's a lot of pollinator content and tips on how to rewild your yard and make it more wildlife-friendly on my blog as well.
And it's zerowastehomestead.com if anybody wants to check that out. Lots of good information there. What got you interested in homesteading, garden sustainability? What is it that pulled you in?
Yeah, so it really started, I bought my first homestead, and it was it had been owned by a lady who knew a lot about gardening, and at the time, I didn't know a lot about gardening, but I was very interested in rehabbing her old garden, so I kind of learned a lot kind of on the fly by trying to put her garden back together, and that taught me a lot, and then I've always been interested in kind of conservation issues and living more eco-friendly. So while I was building my homestead, that was definitely an influential part of just learning how to reduce my impact.
Oh, certainly. And you're in Maine, is that right?
I am, yes.
Is that where you grew up?
No, I'm originally from Pennsylvania, but I've been in Maine for a while. I did the Master Gardening Program through the University of Maine, so that has helped me learn more about gardening. But Maine does have some short growing seasons.
Yes, well, we can kind of relate a little bit here in Wisconsin,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
We got an email from Jane in Oregon, Wisconsin, and she loves doing companion planting, and she's done I was having a hard time. Nasturtiums, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and winter squash. My tongue just doesn't want to wrap around that. And she said it's going really, really well, but she has a question. Can you suggest a good companion plant, either a flower or a vegetable, for potatoes? They have had a lot of beetles this year and hope to find something to put close by or in between to reduce the coal potato beetle.
Ooh, okay, that's a good one. So nasturtiums are actually a good one for potatoes. Sweet alyssum can be a good one, too. It's a small ground-covering plant with tiny little purple or white flowers. It attracts something known as a hoverfly, which is a tiny little fly that looks a bit like a bee. And these hoverflies can actually take care of a lot of caterpillar and grub problems. So if you're having a beetle problem, that's a good one to grow nearby.
So you must do a lot of work where you bring in natural, like a predator, to take care of the not so great bugs in your garden.
Yes, definitely. So I do keep an organic garden. And so that is largely why I use companion plants so much, because a lot of these plants are really great at attracting predatory insects like hoverflies, lacewings, ladybugs. Wasps are actually really great for that as well. And then beyond companion plants, installing some bird boxes or some bat houses in your garden can also really help to reduce pest issues.
Oh, that's a good one, too, is having those birds. They're great to look at. But, yeah, they do eat those.
They do, yeah. Very helpful to have around.
We were just talking with our guest beforehand about what she recommends for the winter garden, or not the winter garden, but going from fall into winter. And what do you not? Should you cut everything down? Should you leave it? What do you do?
For a vegetable garden?
Yeah.
So I have a mix of annual and perennial plants. I do have some perennial rhubarb and asparagus in my garden, so I obviously leave those in place. I let the fall frost kind of kill the plants, so I don't really remove much until then. And then I do pull out most of the annual vegetables at that point, because I found that that is one of the best ways to reduce pests and problems like powdery mildew, is just to do a good garden cleanup in fall. And then I usually burn the stuff that I remove instead of putting in the compost pile, just to make sure nothing's overwintering.
That was going to be my next question. Thank you for answering that.
Yeah.
Lauren, it's been a joy to talk with you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks for joining us again. We've been talking with Lauren Lander. She's a master gardener, writer, and public speaker. Want to thank our team here at The Larry Mueller Show, Clara Neipert, Joel Patinod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, and of course, Larry Mueller. I'm the executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and thank you so much for being with us. Hope you join us again.